Thank you for inviting me. It's always nice to preach at the choir. So at the outset, I want to start, I want to set the context. In this country, we have very decent and very high immunization coverage rates. And this is due to the efforts of a lot of entities represented in this room at the federal level, the CDC, HHS, and at the state and local level, the health departments. Especially since the 90s, we have seen a lot of increases in coverage, and so much so that the DTP3 coverage in this country is more than 90%. Obviously, there's variability. Excuse me, you'll have to excuse me. I have bad allergies, so I'll be coughing in the middle, sorry. So there's variability by vaccine, but vaccine series, et cetera, but we have pretty high immunization coverage rates. So why are we concerned about exemptions? Well, we are concerned, if you are concerned about this area above the curve, which is between this and 100%, for example, even for DTP3 coverage, if they were uniformly distributed, we would have been actually pretty okay. But as I will show, they're not uniformly distributed, and I'll show the consequences of that. But also, the coverage varies by vaccine and series, so that has also implications. This is a nice conceptual diagram that came out, that's from a paper that came out in the late 90s, that shows, that conceptually shows the evolution of an immunization program. On the x-axis of this graph is the maturity of an immunization program, and on the y-axis, it's the incidence, rates, et cetera. And you start in the phase where you have the pre-vaccine era, where you have high rates of a disease, and that pushes people to develop vaccines against those. And you start vaccinating people, and that results in an increase in coverage. You slowly start increasing the coverage, the disease comes down, and at some point, there's a switch in the public perception of successive cohorts of parents who see less of disease than the real and often perceived adverse events due to vaccines. And so that switch results in a lot of people losing confidence in vaccines, and there's a drop in coverage, and lo and behold, people realize that it wasn't a spiritual miracle, it was because of the vaccines that you were keeping the rates of vaccine-preventable diseases low, and you start seeing outbreaks. This has happened in many places, and once that happens, a lot of people start accepting vaccines, and this cycle goes on. Obviously, this is a theoretical diagram. It's not followed exactly. But the key, in my mind, for public health practitioners and researchers is to prevent these cycles and to blunt the effect of these cycles through our interventions. Obviously, if we removed all vaccines tomorrow, there will be disease and people will start demanding vaccines. That's a no-brainer. But the key is to have interventions that prevents these cycles, because this is not a benign phenomenon. It involves real lives, real morbidity, and real mortality. So state laws in the United States are based on, as the name suggests, at the state level, because we have a federal system. They have played a major role in lowering and keeping low the rates of vaccine-preventable diseases. And as Dr. Offit mentioned, there are exemptions allowed to these immunization requirements, and there are three main kinds of exemptions: medical, religious, and philosophical, personal belief exemptions. Some people call them philosophical exemptions. As someone who likes a little bit of philosophy and likes to read up on some folks, I find it interesting because philosophical often, at least to me, implies there's some rational thinking involved, which is always not the case. And so most of the work and most of my talk has focused on medical and religious on religious and personal belief exemptions, as we call them, non-medical exemptions. But recently, at least our group has started focusing on the appropriate use of medical exemptions as well. So I'm going to show a little bit of data on that as well. So as you know, there is variability in exemption requirements, availability of exemptions and immunization requirements by state. More or less, actually all states allow medical exemptions. Most people don't have a problem with the concept of a medical exemption. So there's one can argue about how judiciously it is applied, but the concept of medical exemption most people wouldn't argue with. But then all but two states allow religious exemptions, and around 21 states allow philosophical exemptions in addition to religious exemptions. It has been shown by many people that at the individual level, being exempted poses a risk, a substantial risk of vaccine-preventable diseases, even in this day and age. So there was this very nice study by Fiken in Colorado, from Colorado, that looked at the data from 87 through 98, and they found that the relative risk was of getting measles in that period was 22 times. So the relative risk was 22, and the risk was, that means that the risk was 22 times, not percent, times higher in exempt children compared to vaccinated children. Similarly, the risk of acquiring pertussis at the individual level was 6 times higher in exempt children compared to vaccinated children. Similarly, in a cohort study, the US-wide cohort study, the relative risk of measles was 35, i.e. the risk of the individual risk of acquiring measles was 35 times higher in exempt kids compared to vaccinated kids. There was another nice study by Rota that came out in 2001, and she looked at the administrative, the complexity and the ease of administrative procedures to obtain exemptions, and she associated that with the exemption rates. This is, this slide crudely presents data from that, and this, on the y-axis, you have the number of states, and on the x-axis, you have the categories, the administrative categories that they came up with, easy, medium, difficult procedures for obtaining exemptions. And as you can see, very crudely, that there are no states with, and these bars, reflect the level of exemption rates. And so the green is low exemption rates, medium is yellow, and the men are really bad with naming colors. So the pinkish magenta color is states with high exemption rates. As you can see from this slide, that there are no states in the difficult administrative procedures category that have high exemption rates. Obviously, this is a bit of a crude representation of data, but I think it's pretty convincing because of the enormity of effect. So we knew that easy process results in or is associated with high exemption rates. We also knew from other studies that exemption rates are associated with individual risk of pertussis and measles. But we wanted to see whether state policies have a direct impact on disease incidence. So with this, we did this national study, and what we found that states, this was our reference for this level of analysis, states that had only religious exemptions compared to these states that had personal belief exemptions had the incidence of pertussis from 86 through 2004, which was almost twice as high as these states. Similarly, if you looked at the data by exemption ease, the result was similar. The incidence of pertussis was, again, almost twice as high in states that had easy procedures for granting exemptions compared to difficult procedures. The effect was blunted a little bit, but didn't go away, both substantially and statistically, if you adjusted for demographics. And so even with that, it was at least 50% high. Think about it. We are talking about state-level legislative policies having a direct impact on disease incidence in a state. We wanted to highlight that policies have consequences. So again, so was this a static phenomenon, or what is the should we be concerned about an increase in these rates of exemptions? So this is a crude plot that looks at exemption rate and by year, and this is through 2003, but the trend continues after that. And we saw that, yeah, there was somewhat, starting in the mid-90s, there was a bit of a rise in non-medical exemption rates. However, what became clear that the states that granted personal belief exemptions were almost solely responsible for this increase. And these data, we updated this slide after our publication came out in 2006, so it has data through 2007. And these states, and we did statistical tests, and this increase is statistically significant, so on an average, it's 6% increase of the baseline rate that we see every year, that we saw in this period. If we looked at the states by the ease of granting exemptions, again, it was almost exclusively due to states that had an easy exemption policy. And so not only that exemptions had an impact on disease, but the rates are also going up, primarily because of state-level policies. So okay, this was happening at the state level, but as I like to say, the disease, it does not go from Tallahassee to Sacramento. It goes from one individual to another individual. So it's not an amorphous entity, and those individuals live and are better categorized by more finer geographic entities. And so this is this slide shows exemption rates from 2006-2007 school year from Washington, and the overall state-level exemption rate for those that school year was around 6%, which is okay. But if you look at the county-level data, it ranges from 1.2% to around 27% in one of the counties. Think about it. This is almost one in four kids exempt to one or another vaccine. But the question is, as someone who gets his salary from an academic institution, I get asked the question whether this is statistically significant and whether this is the appropriate geographic aggregation. I'm going to take you through a little bit of methods, because that's an important question, whether, you know, if you see this diversity in rates, whether it's believable. So we use these relatively novel methods of identifying clusters. The way it works is that the spatial algorithm divides the, and this is called the scan statistic based method, where you divide the spatial plane, which is into a grid, and you have a moving window of that the software goes through, and the events are distributed by location, and this moving window expands at each grid point and stops at the level where the contrast of events inside versus outside is maximized. So that's the ideal side of that window. And it computes a test statistic for that window, and it moves to the next grid point and so on and so forth, and does it for the event data set. But it also does it approximately, it's arbitrary, but the convention is to do it 999 times for under simulated conditions of a known null hypothesis. If we knew that the distribution is just by chance, what would the data look like? And we compute that and compare the test statistics from the real and the 909 hypothetical distributions, and we see if it's more extreme than 95%, we say that the data are significant, this cluster is significant. If it's not, then we say it's not. And so what this gives us, that it gives you not only the location, but also the significance of these clusters. So we use these methods to look at data in Michigan, and this shows the schools census tracts in pertussis clusters in Michigan. And the green dots are schools in exemption clusters. So we wanted to associate clusters of exemptions with actual, some model to model these outbreaks, and we showed that. But then the next step was to look at the census tracts within exemptions clusters given in blue, and the census tracts in pertussis clusters. You can see there's a reasonable, for those of you who have done spatial epidemiology, it's pretty decent overlap, and it's more obvious if you blow up the Detroit metropolitan area, it's pretty substantial. When we quantified that, the odds ratios of overlap, unadjusted odds ratios were 3, and when you adjusted for it, it was still 2.7. So we wanted to see if this was unique to Michigan, and what we found was, no, it wasn't. There was clustering in California and Massachusetts. And in these states, we did another kind of analysis. We said, okay, we're not just modeling outbreak-related, or i.e. cluster disease. We are looking at all disease, and if you look at the incidence rate ratios of pertussis inside versus outside clusters in California, the incidence was 25% higher if you lived inside the cluster versus outside the cluster. And if you look at the highest impact was in 5 to 17 years old. The phenomenon was true. The overall phenomenon was true for Massachusetts as well, but we didn't have stratified data by age for Massachusetts. So how does this work in outbreaks? Generally, if you track outbreaks, what happens is that there's a critical mass of susceptible that is out there in the community, i.e. the exempt people, and when there is an introduction of a case, you see that earlier on it's the exempters that compose a higher proportion of folks who are, who provide that critical mass to ignite the outbreak. And as the outbreak moves, their proportion goes down and the general community is affected. So this was seen in 2008, where the rates of measles were almost as high as we had seen as anything we had seen in almost a decade or so, and the proportion of direct imports was pretty low. So these people who were primarily driving the epidemic. There was a nice paper that came out in Pediatrics looking at some of the San Diego specific data. And if you look at it, the reasons for not getting vaccinated, almost 2/3 of those who were eligible to get vaccination didn't get vaccinated because of exemptions. So who refuses vaccines? We did this case control study where we looked at these constructs of disease susceptibility, disease severity, vaccine efficacy, and vaccine safety. That's four domains from the health beliefs model. And we looked at the low trust in healthcare provider and low trust in government, and we saw that for against all of these domains, the parents of non-medically exempt children were likely to have higher proportion in all of these categories compared to the vaccinated. But not only in this, if you look at it, the magnitude is the highest for perceptions regarding low vaccine safety. And there's a ton of work that has shown that it's a mistake to consider it vaccine exemptions and refusal behavior as a one-dimensional behavior. But at the same time, if you quantify the magnitude, in terms of the magnitude, it's the vaccine perceptions regarding vaccine safety, as Paul highlighted in his presentation, that fuel a lot of this. So there was a very nice paper by Phil Smith that came out and said, okay, he compared kids who were characteristics of zero-dose kids, and the assumption was the zero-dose kids, at least it was implicit that the zero-dose kids are kids who do not get, who make a conscious decision of not getting vaccinated versus under-vaccinated kids. And what they found was that the unvaccinated, totally unvaccinated children were more likely to be male, white, belong to households with higher income, married mother with a college education, and live with more than 4 kids. A colleague characterizes this as a crunchy granola crowd, but I don't think that's the accurate description because it spans a lot of attitudes. So Where are these people, where are parents getting their information and which information sources they trust, because that's a part of intervention. And we found that overall, the trust in healthcare providers was higher in vaccinated parents, but still, for the higher ones, like healthcare providers, et cetera, the, you know, these sources ranked really high, even for exempt children. And so that's very interesting. What we did was, we did this interesting thing. We, you know, we collected data in the same server for DPT, dissatisfied parents together, and their new incarnation, National Vaccine Information Center. And if you look at this, actually their brand, their branding was a bit successful, because if you ask the question differently, the it sounded more official, and the trust rates went up in both exempt and vaccinated. So yeah, branding works. So then we wanted to look at what is happening at the provider level, and we wanted to see whether there was an overlap between the exempt kids and their providers and their attitudes, and the vaccinated kids and their providers and their attitudes. So we looked at these, we traced individual level exempt and vaccinated kids provider, and we evaluated them against these same four domains that I discussed earlier, and we looked at healthcare providers that overlapped in terms of odds ratios. So I'm not going to go into the details of the methods, but these odds ratios signify the overlap between the perceptions of parents, i.e. those in exempt versus vaccinated, versus those of the healthcare providers. And as you can see, that none of these are statistically significant, although all of them are more than one, but both in terms of the magnitude of overlap and the significance is the perceptions regarding vaccine safety that bring certain types of providers and parents together. Since this was a cross-sectional study, I can't say whether certain kinds of providers attract certain kinds of parents or it's the other way around, but I think it's a bit of both. So as I mentioned, a graduate student of mine has looked at some of the new data on on medical exemptions. We looked at 4 school years worth of data, and as you know, some states grant only temporary medical exemptions. Some grant both permanent and temporary. Some grant only permanent exemptions medical exemptions. And if you look at it, the exemption rates compared to temporary-only states, states that have permanent and temporary medical exemptions, the exemption rates are almost twice as high. This is not significant, but if you look at, but the trend is there, but if you look at the permanent-only states, they are 4 times as high as states that have temporary-only medical exemptions. So it's not, I think we should, although the magnitude of medical exemptions is much lower than the magnitude of non-medical exemptions, but we should continue to think about this. There's this new trend of, as I like to say, of treating your kids' health as a real estate deal, where the people, some parents try to split the difference and say, I'm going to get my kid vaccinated, but I'm going to get them vaccinated right when the exemptions kick in. Well, I think you know, the language I grew up has a saying in that it's almost like a joyless sin, because you're getting them vaccinated when they are, you have left that huge area under the cover and they are more susceptible to vaccine preventable diseases, which is early childhood. And the risk is not constant. But here's the other thing. What kinds of parents can literally afford to stagger multiple vaccination visits? More affluent parents. But if this trend starts crossing socioeconomic status, I think there's a bit of a risk of exacerbating vaccine disparities. So I'll end my talk by a few conclusions. I think effective administrative controls and specific laws have an important role in controlling vaccine preventable diseases, and there should be a balance. The ease of filing paperwork shouldn't be lower than getting your kid vaccinated. Vaccine refusal should at least be a function of conviction, not laziness. And so you should. So it's a common sense balance that one should strike. And then identification of high-risk geographical areas is important because the impact of an unvaccinated cluster impacts the overall risk, even in the non-exempt population. And we need to engage local stakeholders, including local PTAs, et cetera, that will bring to bear a lot of pressure locally so that implementation and legislation of policies is influenced. And as I highlighted, providers are important in this scheme. And I think there's a methodological area that we are working on, and I think others should look at. Perhaps states should start reporting a clustering statistic in addition to just an overall exemption rates. Thank you.